This week, a House committee voted to cut funding for the James Webb Space Telescope, Hubble's successor. Seems the committee's aim was to punish NASA and send a message to the rest of the government, come in over budget and you too may get the axe. Can the Webb Telescope be salvaged? Hubble was over budget. Why is this so different? Congressional muscle tried and failed to pull the plug on new standards for making light bulbs more energy efficient. We'll find out what the new regs mean for light bulb design. Will some bulbs disappear from store shelves? Why are fluorescents and LEDs so much better? Plus, a new strain of gonorrhea is overpowering the last line of antibiotics. Should we be afraid? What are the alternatives? Some answers in your questions after this break. Stay with us. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. A new strain of gonorrhea has been found, a strain that scientists say is highly resistant to the last remaining antibiotics that doctors have in their arsenal to treat the bacterial infection. At one time, gonorrhea was easily cured with penicillin, but once it developed resistance to that, other antibiotics like Cipro had to be used. But this new strain beats that one, too. So far, it has appeared only in Japan, but what's to stop it from spreading? Are we without defenses against this new strain? Has our onslaught of antibiotics created another superbug? How worried should we be? Joining us to tell us more is Dr. Peter Leone. He's professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, also chair-elect of the National Coalition of STD Directors. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Leone.
Thank you, Ira. It's great to be back.
This sounds pretty scary.
It is. It's a big concern. We knew that this would happen at some point, but the fact that we have this report out of Japan showing high-level resistance is quite concerning. It's the first one we've seen that has this degree of resistance to our last class of antibiotics to treat gonorrhea.
When you say, is it then not total resistance, or is it very, very resistant?
No, this one is very, very resistant. The issue is that, you know, when we do these tests to look at how sensitive the bacteria is to the drug, we use what we call minimal inhibitory concentration. So it tells us how much antibiotic is needed in order to be able to stop growth of the bacteria. We can get a rough correlation with what that means in terms of treatment. Well, this new strain was 500-fold more resistant than anything we've seen before. And so that means that it's likely to result in treatment failure. Interestingly enough, the woman who was treated did not respond to the antibiotics and then appeared to spontaneously clear the organism. So I think we've got a lot of concern. It doesn't mean that we couldn't treat if we use very high doses of antibiotics, but we'd have to be looking at IV dosing in order to be able to treat someone with that kind of strain.
So that means anybody and everybody who got this strain would have to have IV dosing.
That's correct. And, of course, you know, gonorrhea is the number two most common reportable disease in the United States. It's about 700,000 cases a year. It's associated with pelvic inflammatory disease and potential tubal infertility in women. And in men, it can cause urethritis, infection of the testicles. And in particular, gonorrhea has been associated with increasing the risk of transmission and acquisition of HIV. So this is a big concern. It's not just a nuisance bug.
And should we then expect it to naturally spread from Japan through Japan to the rest of the world?
Yes. In fact, the pattern that we saw with the quinolones, a drug that we used back in the 90s, it followed this exact pattern. We saw resistance start in the east out of Japan and the Southeast Asia, moved to Hawaii and the west coast of the United States, and then quickly spread throughout the rest of the country. This pattern of cephalosporin resistance gonorrhea is exactly the same. The rate that we can expect, though, this to spread is unknown. So we don't know if we're talking about a few years or a decade, and that's the concern. We need to take advantage of the time we have right now to be prepared and to deal with this.
And how would we do that?
Well, that's the other dilemma. This couldn't have happened at a worse time, where we've got financial crisis in the United States, and we're losing our ability in terms of shutting down dedicated STD clinics throughout the United States. Many states do not have any dedicated STD clinics anymore. Ironically, some of the tests that we use to diagnose gonorrhea, which are very sensitive, miss being able to pick up the organism because it doesn't involve cultures. And so we don't know necessarily if treatment failure is due to re-exposure or to resistance. Secondly, we're seeing a lot of gonorrhea now occurring in the throat and the rectum, and there are no FDA-approved tests for diagnosis of gonorrhea in the throat and the rectum. We can use these tests for non-FDA approval, but many clinicians don't know how to order that test or may not have it available in their institution.
Wow.
Yeah, I agree. So, I think it's time to actually begin to have real discussions around it. I know the folks at the CDC are very attentive to this, but that means really getting clinicians to look for this infection in other sites. Typically, what we see in men is symptoms when they have infection of their urethra, but if they have rectal or throat infection, most of those individuals have no symptoms. So unless a person is screened for it and screened with an appropriate test, what we call nucleic acid amplification test, it may be missed, and then that would allow them to transmit infection to other folks.
But doesn't gonorrhea present a challenge in that it's hard to see the symptoms sometimes?
Well, the symptoms in men is not usually missed when it involves the urethra. I mean, most guys, when they have pus coming out of their penis, are going to go in and be seen right away. And about 95% of men who have urethral involvement do develop symptoms. But half of women do not. So if we're not screening women, we may miss that. But we've seen changes in sexual practices in the United States. Much more oral sex and rectal sex, and as a result, infection with gonorrhea in those areas cause little to no symptoms. In fact, the majority of folks have no symptoms. So unless a person is asked specifically about the type of sex they have, they're screened with a swab from those areas, and the right test is ordered, which is nucleic acid amplification test, they may be missed entirely. And, of course, infection in these areas may go on for weeks to months, which means that the potential for transmission could be pretty significant.
Can you be a carrier and not know it?
Yes. In fact, that's the big concern. In fact, this case that was reported out of Japan was in a commercial sex worker. She had infection in her throat. That's where they picked up the organism. She had no symptoms. That's sort of the classic situation, and it's almost the perfect storm because people don't have symptoms. They can be carriers and transmit it to someone else. So I want to be very clear about this. If men have infection of their urethra, they'll have pus, they'll have burning. Most guys, if they have pus coming out of their penis, aren't going to sit around for a few days. They'll go in and be seen. Mm-hmm. But if you're not having symptoms in these other places, you may not go in. And even if you go in to be seen, you may not be screened at the appropriate site.
And if you're not screened, or even if you have it, then it's going to take an IV, heavy IV dose of antibiotics to cure it.
If you have this high-level resistance, fortunately, we've not seen that one in the United States, and we haven't seen treatment failure. What is concerning is the recent reports that came out of the MMWR and CDC from a national gonococcal surveillance project, which found that the minimal amount of drug to suppress growth of the organism has been increasing, and increasing pretty significantly over the last decade, and that's occurring in Hawaii and California, but has been seen throughout the whole United States. That's exactly the trend that we saw with the quinolones, ciprofloxacin, and within a decade we lost the ability to use that drug to treat gonorrhea. So the concern here is that the creeping, rising MIC is certainly there. We need to raise awareness. We need to make sure that people are screened properly, and treatment has to be changed. We were using oral antibiotics to treat gonorrhea. The recommendations now, first line, is to use two drugs that would include an IM injection, so an injection into the muscle with a drug called ceftriaxone, as well as taking an oral medication, azithromycin. The concern there is that many clinicians in private practices and offices throughout the United States do not have ceftriaxone on hand and may not recognize that we now recommend two-drug treatment for gonorrhea in the United States.
So they're not even up to date on the latest treatments for it.
No. And again, this comes back to my concern about public health dollars and infrastructure building around STD programs in the United States, that our ability to avoid sort of superbug spreading is really based on good surveillance and then education of clinicians out there, sort of our first line of picking up cases. And that infrastructure is really being severely eroded, and we may see this bug emerge very dramatically over the next couple of years. if we lose the ability to treat this with ceftriaxone, we do not have any other effective antibiotics that we can use, and there are none currently in the pipeline. So it's a big concern.
So we go back to the 19th century?
Well, you know, we have talked about this, sort of the post-antibiotic era for gonorrhea. I don't think this is going to happen overnight, but if we're not vigilant about this and we don't provide more support for surveillance and education and appropriate treatment, then we will. And if you go back in the literature and read about what happened back in the 1800s and early 1900s before we used sulfonamides and penicillin, there were these crude devices of irrigating men's urethras, you know, in order to be able to prevent them from developing stricture and try to clear the organism. I mean, they were pretty crude devices.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, with lack of money and to open public health clinics, those aren't there either.
They're not. And, you know, I understand that we need healthcare reform. We're moving folks back into the primary care setting. But that means changing sort of the role of public health, if that's the case, to assure that appropriate diagnostics are available and treatment is available. Massachusetts is a great example. They have no dedicated STD clinics in the state of Massachusetts. Many individuals who have an STD want to be seen immediately. They don't necessarily want to go in to see their private physician. They may not want to share information about the type of sexual activity they engage in. We've lost sort of that early entry point, easy access point for folks. So I think we have to take a good look at where people go for care now and make sure that information is out there, the primary care physicians in particular.
And so with this new strain potentially going around the world, then people have to be proactive themselves in seeking the care they need?
Well, I would say in particular for men who have sex with men, in which we're seeing this emerge most dramatically, and in whom we worry the greatest about transmission and acquisition of HIV, they should be going in and asking if they're engaging in oral or anal sex to have a nucleic acid amplification test, a swab done from their throat and rectum when they're seen. And if they're not using barrier methods, condoms with sex, which many people do not when they're having oral sex, then they should be being screened at least every 3 months. And we're recommending that same population get an HIV test every 3 months. So I think we need to be pegging STD screening with our HIV interventions, and hopefully we'll be able to stem the tide or slow down the progression of this spread.
Well, thanks for the good news.
Yeah, right. Be safe out there.
Oh, gosh. All right, Dr. Leone, thanks for coming back on Science Friday. We'll try to keep up with this. This is really sounds very serious, and I'm glad you're here to tell us about it.
I'll keep you posted.
Thank you. Dr. Peter Leone, he's professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill and chair-elect of the National Coalition of STD Directors, Sexually Transmitted Diseases. We're going to switch gears and come back and talk about James Webb Space Telescope up next. So stay with us. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI. You can also go to our website at sciencefriday.com and get into a discussion. We'll be right back after this break. Do you disagree with something our guest said? Maybe something even I said? Or maybe you've got a suggestion for a future show? Well, now you can leave us a voicemail on the telephone. Here's that number, 724-374-3063. That's 724-374-3063. And we might just play it during a future show. But there's only one rule. You've got to keep it short, under 60 seconds. The clock is ticking. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, the continuing battle to fund the James Webb Space Telescope, or the battle to kill it, whichever way that you want to look at it. This week, the House Appropriations Committee approved a bill to kill funding for the James Webb Space Telescope in 2012. The telescope, which is the Hubble telescope's replacement, is over budget and behind schedule. In cutting the funding, the House committee said it was in effect punishing NASA and making an example out of it by saying, quote, significant cost overruns are commonplace at NASA, and the committee believes that the underlying cause will never be fully addressed if the Congress does not establish clear consequences for failing to meet budget and schedule expectations, unquote. The full House and Senate would still need to vote on this bill, so there's a chance the Webb could be saved. But should it? Billions have been spent already. Would we be sending good money after bad? Or would it be wrong to pull out now after all this money has been spent? And after all, it was the Hubble Space Telescope which sent back those terrific pictures, which was also over budget by the time it was done. What do you think? Tell us on Facebook, or you can tweet us your thoughts at SciFry. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Joining me to talk more about the web, the problems that have plagued it, and what might happen are my guests, Michael S. Turner, director and distinguished professor at Kavli Institute for Cosmological Physics at the University of Chicago. Welcome back to Science Friday, Michael.
I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Ron Cowan is a former reporter for Science News. He's now a freelancer and writer for The Washington Post, Science and Nature. He joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome back, Ron.
Hi,
Ron.
Thanks, Ira.
Michael, tell us what is so important and revolutionary about this telescope.
Well, I think the Webb is the successor, as you said, to the Hubble Space Telescope. And in every dimension, it's a quantum leap. Seven times the collecting area. It will be a million miles from Earth at L2, which is a much better observing site. It will go in the infrared, and the importance of the infrared is the most interesting things in the universe have their light in the infrared. So distant objects where it's redshifted, cool things that are forming, like planetary systems, and also things that are shrouded by dust. You can see through the dust in the infrared. And so the science goals of the James Webb Space Telescope are to look at the first stars and galaxies, to watch galaxies being assembled from their individual parts, stars and dark matter, and so on and so forth, image planets, and perhaps find evidence for water on the planets, and watch the birth of stars and planetary systems. I think in one short statement, you know, the Hubble revolutionized astronomy, and I think the Webb telescope has just as much or even more potential.
Ryan, wasn't the Hubble over budget too?
Yes, it was. I think, maybe triple what its original budget was, something like that. And, I mean, you know, it just seems to me this is what – actually, I was speaking to Alan Boss this morning, who was – he's chair of a subcommittee that advises NASA, and what he's saying is that, you know, okay, if you want to punish NASA, well, this is not like a trip to the woodshed. This is like a trip to the guillotine, and that you know, to kill the whole mission doesn't, I think, make sense. There have been a lot of cost overruns, and you see, there's a lot of pressures in the article I wrote in April for Science News. Even when this mission was first proposed something like 15 years ago, people were afraid to say how much it would really cost. Mm-hmm. And Mike Griffin, who's a former administrator of NASA, said, it's a game of you lie and I'll swear to it. But Congress is, in a way, part of this game, because if the mission, perhaps, if the actual budget was stated in the first place for how much it would really cost, people feared, at least, that they would say, no, forget about it. We'll never do something for $5 billion or $6.5 billion.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I could put that in perspective a little. This is a very, very ambitious project. And about a year ago, Senator Mikulski was worried about how the project was proceeding. And I think what started the sequence of events that led to what the House did last week was this report that came out led by Kasani, the Kasani reporter, the Independent Cost Review Panel. And basically what they said was this project is going to cost at least $1.5 billion more than one thought. So that would put it closer to $7 billion, that it has been mismanaged, but money has not been wasted. So the real issue is what Ron was saying, is that the mismanagement was headquarters and Goddard kind of playing footsie and not being honest with the real cost or the schedule. And, you know, to put it in perspective, right now it's about 75% done. An analogy I heard the other day, it's as if you're putting together an airplane or a car and you've ordered parts from around the world and you get a report that all the parts are made and all that we have left to do is to assemble it.
So we've got most of the pieces together, and now is the time to assemble it. More than half of the money has been spent. There are no technical hurdles. I should have said that. The Kasani panel said there are no technical hurdles. This is very, very ambitious, but they have surmounted the technical hurdles. They just need more money to get this done. Mm-hmm. Now, given the current situation with our budget, and this is something I'm not qualified to comment on because I'm a scientist and very excited about this. This country has real budgetary problems. And the question is, who are we really punishing if we cancel this project where we spent close to $4 billion and there's only $3 billion left to spend? Who are we punishing? Is that teaching NASA a lesson, or are we being penny wise and pound foolish?
Mm-hmm. I think the problem also is that each year that this mission is delayed, and this is also what the Kasani report said, it's going to cost more money and more money and more money. The fear is that it will cost so much if you don't give it the funding it needs now that if it wouldn't get launched in 2022 or something, it wouldn't get launched at all because it would be that much more costly. And that was the problem all along because it was originally set for launch in 2010 or 2011, and each year that it didn't get the money it needed, it cost more and more money. You have to keep personnel and together and everything, and it just costs more.
But is there not something to the point that if everybody was playing this game of what it really cost, and there was, I'll use the word deception early on, because we were winking and nodding to each other about what mm-hmm. the real cost of it should be. Isn't there some justification in saying, you know, you guys should have been up front with us and we could have made a decision then on this?
Well, let me comment on that. I think what NASA really does is rocket science. And it's not building widgets. It's really pushing the edge of what is possible. And for the most part, NASA projects are on schedule and on budget. And every once in a while, we're talking about two of the examples today, the Hubble and the James Webb. NASA does a project where you're really literally reaching for the stars, and you are taking a giant leap forward. And, again, Hubble, I think, was over by more than what Ron said, and it just fundamentally changed astronomy, added to American pride, and it convulsed NASA. And so I think the big dilemma is how do you deal with these big projects that are going to produce game changers, where you really reach maybe a little beyond your grasp to try to do something really, really big? And how do you wall that off and prevent it from causing larger problems? And I think the number one lesson from this report from a year ago is, at the very least, you always have to be upfront. That if you're hiding the true schedule and cost, that's not going to serve anyone well. And I think that's a very important lesson to learn. I think people were shocked a year ago that the number, the additional amount of money was so large. And so I think that's a very, very important lesson. But I would not want NASA not to try to reach for the stars, because NASA is us. And when we do things like the Hubble, and when we do things like the James Webb, no other nation can do that. And great nations like ours do great things. And the Hubble and the Webb, I think, are examples of that.
Mm-hmm. Rob, have the problems been rectified, the management problems, since that report?
Well, yeah, it seems so, in the sense that the James Webb Space Telescope has been taken out of the astrophysics division, and it has its own. It's managed by one special group that reports directly to, I think, the administrator. So it seems so. What I think concerns me, though, is that, they're not. I am not hearing NASA saying how much extra now it will cost if it doesn't get launched in 2018 or 2020. I heard one report that maybe they know it, but that they are not going to say, or the administration doesn't want to say what it will cost till next February when the president proposes its next year's budget. Mm-hmm. So, I think they need to be upfront now and say how much more it's going to cost. But, yes, I think they have it seems like they have taken care of those mismanagement problems. I think so.
I think, Ron, I remember reading that Costa's embargoed till 2013.
Yes, that may be right.
Is this the death of it? If the funding is cut off for 2012, mm-hmm. there's still money left over for some of it, but that would take a year away, and where would all those people stay on staff or go? Or
yeah, I think realistically, if you zero it out in 12,
yes.
You're right. You have this marching army ready to finish it, and it's going to disassemble. So I think I was sitting in on this meeting that Ron was talking about yesterday, this advisory committee, and Rick Howard at NASA headquarters was the person who reorganized the headquarters oversight. And I think from the perspective of the astronomy community listening to Rick, he's done a terrific job of reorganizing it, instituting transparency. And that being said, NASA is now between a rock and a hard place. In the following sense. So they've done a replan, as they call it. They've gone all the way up the management chain at headquarters to make sure everybody's on board. And they're now talking with the President's Office of Management and Budget to try to work out something. And right now would not be the time to go public and say, here is our plan, while you're still trying to work with the President and ultimately the Congress to fit it in, because if you go forward now, people's going to grab on to the most optimistic plan or the most mm-hmm. pessimistic plan. And some of this work does need to be behind closed doors. But you do identify the problem that if there's no funding in 2012, that will all but kill the project. And so I think that's the big issue. And the House has spoken. The Senate has yet to speak. And I think the people have yet to speak. I noticed that there's now a website that has been put up by some graduate students asking for people to sign a petition to go to Congress to make sure that the James Webb goes forward. So this issue is going to start heating up.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Let's go to the phones to Casey. Before I get to Casey, let me read a tweet that says, maybe we could sell the completed parts to the Chinese and let them finish it.
Oh, I think that's exactly what we don't need to do. I mean, this country is a great country. And
maybe we're finished. Maybe we're just finished in space.
I don't think we are. I think
we don't have that vision and we don't care. We're talking just a few billion bucks here to finish it.
Yeah, I think we've done such a good job after World War II of helping the rest of the world to build capability that all of a sudden we've got Europe and Asia that are almost our equals, and so we're a little bit spooked. But we're still the only nation that can mount such a telescope like the James Webb or the Hubble, and we need to go forward and do it. For us to step back right now and say, oh boy, we'll just let the Chinese do it, I think that would be such a blow, not only to science, but to national pride.
Casey in Grand Rapids, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Hi there.
I'd like to see the project of the Webb completed, but I'm curious, is it possible for NASA to get private funding or sponsors to help pay for the mismanagement instead of having the taxpayers float the bill?
Thanks for calling.
Well, that's an interesting question. Astronomy, unlike most other sciences, there is a history of philanthropy. And I guess we've already given away the name. Maybe we could add a sponsor's name to it. That's not a solution I've seen, but certainly in astronomy, we name there's the Keck telescope and other telescopes named after their donors. That would be a creative way to solve the problem.
There are people who say that this telescope is taking up too much of NASA's budget, other science suffering because this is so expensive. How do you answer that, Michael?
I mean, it has taken up 40% of NASA's astrophysics budget. And there are other missions that seem to be in jeopardy, like one that is proposed to look for dark energy, this mysterious stuff that is making the universe expand faster and faster and has been called the biggest puzzle in physics in the over the past century. But I mean, it is also true if you kill this mission now, the James Webb, there won't be a future flagship mission that NASA will have. I think there is so much potential, personally, to make new discoveries. The fact that 75% of it has been completed. What I think has to be done is to make sure that the next game-changing telescope after this, that there are things in place that this mistake won't happen a third time. And it's not clear to me, with all the pressures from Congress, I don't know that they're making it any easier. Punishing is not actually going to solve the overarching problem here, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you raise an important point, Ira, which is that when the web bleeds, the rest of the astrophysics program hemorrhages. And that is a serious problem, because if this is completed, it will put great stress on the rest of the budget. And just to illustrate this, I probably will never use the James Webb Space Telescope, but I'm Mr. Dark Energy, and the project that Ron was talking about, I think, could very well get postponed or squeezed out by the James Webb Space Telescope. And so that is a problem. And I think somehow, I think Ron put his finger on it, fencing it off, more transparency and honesty up front. I think that probably was the biggest problem, not knowing how big a problem this was going to be, because NASA is us, and we are a great nation, and we want to do these game changers.
All right, we're going to have to leave it at there and see what happens as it moves through the Senate. Michael Turner is director of the Kavli Institute for Cosmological Physics, University of Chicago. Ron Cowan, former reporter for Science News, and now a freelancer writing for the Washington Post, Science and Nature. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm sure we'll be back in touch with you. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks,
Ira.
We're going to take a short break and talk about, from the highly technical to the very simple, light bulbs, the future of light bulbs. Again, another topic in Congress. Stay with us. We'll be right back. No need to be locked down to your laptop. You can take Science Friday with you. Find our apps in the iTunes Store and the Android Marketplace so you can really take this show and shove it right into your pocket. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, the future of light bulbs. This week, Congress tried and failed to pull the plug on legislation that would force light bulb makers to start making more energy-efficient bulbs. The Energy Independence and Security Act, which was passed under then-President George W. Bush, remains in place and sets new standards for common household bulbs. The new laws require bulb makers to make the bulbs put out more light per watt. Some bulbs, like the common 100-watt incandescent may have that you have hanging over your kitchen table, well, it may not make the grade, at least in its present form, so they'll be phased out over the next few years. Well, we'll take their place. Lots of folks aren't thrilled with CFLs, compact fluorescents. There's complaints about the quality of the light, concerns about mercury being inside them, and what happens if you drop them and break them. There was, what about the new generations of LEDs? Yes, they're expensive, but they use less energy, and those costs will probably be coming down. So what new technology? What would you like to see? Our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Would you be willing to spend a few extra cents on a compact fluorescent or an LED? Let me bring on my guest. Mark Ray is director of the Lighting Research Center at Rensselaer Polytech Institute in Troy. He joins us from his office there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. The debate about light bulbs is not that compact fluorescents are more efficient. Is it they are more efficient at using electricity? Correct?
Yes, they are.
And so for X number of watts, you get more light out per bulb than incandescent.
Yeah, that's the notion of efficacy, lumens per watt, yes. Mm-hmm. Higher lumens per watt for CFLs and LEDs.
Mm-hmm. But when you decide to go out and buy a CFL, it's a lot. You have more choices than you do than an incandescent. It used to be like, you know, in the old Model T Ford days, you can get any color you want as long as it's black. It's now you just go into, when you buy an incandescent, you get anything you want. It's going to basically have sort of a dullish yellow color, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting. There have been trends over the last 30, 40 years to actually coat incandescent lamps. So that's not strictly true, but generally true. That's right. You do get them in different flavors for CFLs and LEDs, and the choices are much more limited with incandescent. That's true.
Mm-hmm. Are these new regulations going to ban some of the bulbs we have today?
Well, yeah, I think we're already seeing that in California in 2012. Next year, we're going to see the 100-watt lamp, incandescent lamp, as we know it, is going to be disallowed for sale. Yes, that's correct. And then there's a staging to lower wattages being restricted as years to come from 2012.
Mm-hmm. And why do people have problems with this, with the old law, the 2007 law that people in Congress wanted to repeal it?
Well, I think it's really a two-part issue here that comes together. We don't really just have bare light bulbs hanging in our homes. We actually put them into fixtures of various types here. Your family's Tiffany lamp to downlights, and the infrastructure that holds that lamp was designed to hold that particular type of technology, the incandescent lamp. And as if you're focused on lumens per watt or lumens or the light, the bundled features that are associated with an incandescent lamp are not necessarily comparable as you go to a different technology. For example, a CFL tends to weigh more than an incandescent lamp. So if you have a favorite sort of table lamp that is carefully balanced, you put a heavy lamp in there and won't stay up. These features are often forgotten when you're just focused on lumens per watt or lumens. You really have to think about the bundled technologies that fit into the existing infrastructure that's there. And there's some more subtle issues, too. You mentioned color. You know, some people might like to change the decor and change the light source, but other people would just rather just stick to one change. So I think we really haven't discussed these bundled features well enough. And so people come back with a lamp, they expect the same bundled features of an incandescent, and they don't always get it, and they sometimes are disappointed.
Yeah. Let's go to Bob in Bern, Indiana. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
My issue with light bulbs, and I've used light bulbs like LED and fluorescent. My problem with the fluorescent light bulbs is that they tend to be low quality, and even though they promise a high.
Yeah, you're dropping in and out there. So,
I'm sorry.
That's okay. So you're saying they're like cheap bulbs. They're made cheaply.
In my experience, is even though they promise a longer lifespan, especially if they're exposed to any heat, they don't last as long. Sometimes only, you know, I've had some burn out in just a couple of weeks, yeah. Whereas an incandescent light bulb would last longer.
Yeah, good question. Thanks for the call. I have noticed that myself. I'm actually starting, and I have a lot of light bulbs there, and I'm starting to put dates on them in the ceiling ones because they turn brown and burn out, you know, in a matter of months sometimes. Mark.
Yeah, the heat is unkind to some of these technologies. So when you put them into an open air application like your table lamp that's open, you probably will not be disappointed. But if you put them into a closed ceiling fixture, the temperatures rise and the electronic components begin to deteriorate, so you get short life. But one thing, as a purchaser, you need to be aware of the Energy Star label, which goes through a number of testing procedures to make sure that the quality is going to be there. So you can buy those with Energy Star labels, those without. You're much less likely to be disappointed if you get an Energy Star label on the CFL that you're going to buy.
I've tried to find high-quality bulbs. I actually have bulbs that are 15 years old that are still working. The original ones, I think they were made from Philips, somebody like that.
Again, I think that the application of the lamp, I mean, again, it comes back to the incandescent. You know, you can put an incandescent on your porch or you can put it in a ceiling fixture, and it's a robust technology. It's not going to fail. But CFLs do not like hot environments, and so you're more likely to be successful in those applications that minimize heat.
Mm. And this is and fluorescents like to stay on, don't they? You actually wear them out more by turning them on and off. Is that not correct?
Well, that's a bit of an old wives' tale, actually.
Yeah.
Your life is determined by how frequently you switch, but most of the technologies, the cathodes that actually get the light moving in that tube is going to be fine, robust, and from a cost point of view, energy savings, if you leave it off for a minute and a half, you're already recouping the loss that you might get in lamp life from the energy savings you have. So you should not be afraid to turn them off. Turn them off when you don't need them. Absolutely.
There you go. Nancy in Columbus. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for your show, Ira. I look forward to it every year.
You're welcome.
My concern with these new light bulbs is I do not hear people talking or educating the public about disposal. And I'm concerned about most people taking those light bulbs and throwing them into their trash and mercury reentering the water supply and the environment.
Not to mention your house.
Right. Oh, well, you do hear that about if they get dropped in the house. But I am very concerned about them. I love LED lights. I wish everyone would replace their holiday lights with those because those are very polluting also. And I'm not just opposed to change, but I do think these are ugly to look at and they have an ugly light. And I'm concerned about that mercury reentering the environment.
All right. Well, let's get an answer from Mark.
Thank you.
You can go answer your doorbell. Go ahead.
We'll
let
you. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
You know, first of all, I want to point out the U.S. EPA has some guidelines on how to deal with broken CFLs, and that's a good procedure. But one of the things that people often forget is the offset, particularly in Ohio where they burn fossil fuels. You're offsetting more mercury into the environment by using more efficient technology than you are that which is contained within the CFL. Now, obviously, the distribution's different and so on, and there are some considerations with regard to the concentration at any one point, but I think that we've had fluorescent lamps since 1939. They've all contained mercury, much, much less mercury in the last, say, 10 years than they were prior to that. So I think that, yes, it's a legitimate concern. EPA has some guidelines on how to deal with that, but I think the net benefit of mercury into the environment is improved by fluorescent lights rather than mm-hmm. made worse.
How quickly can we expect the LEDs to come down in price?
Well, you know, they say it's a race to the bottom.
Yeah.
Everybody's trying to get cheaper and cheaper products out there. I think you can follow some reasonable trends. I think that people are pretty good at predicting what the price points are going to be over the next 5 years. So there'll be a steady decline year after year for the next 3 to 5 years probably. I don't think it's going to be 60 cents at the checkout counter, but you will definitely have a much less expensive product in 2 to 3 years.
There are many states that subsidize, give you a little rebate for buying CFLs. Possibly they'll do LEDs the same way.
Yes, I think that was certainly the story in compact fluorescence in the late 80s and 90s. Rebates was a large part of trying to transform the market back at that time. It's an interesting sideline, I think, Ira, that that was not very successful. And people, again, focused on just lumens per watt, couldn't understand it. But the form factor of those old CFLs was very different. If you recall, Ira, they had sort of a long tube that stuck out, and sometimes
right.
they stuck down into your ceiling space and that sort of thing. The real transformation came, yes, with price, no question about that. But the form factor that the curly Q or the pigtail shape is the one that really began to get the CFL market moving because it was a form factor that were more consistent with the existing infrastructure that supports them. That was a big deal, just changing the shape.
Yeah, I recall that. One last question for you. It's a tweet, and it comes from DBA John, who says, is there any way that incandescent bulbs could be modified to meet the energy requirements from the law?
Well, it's an interesting thing. That's a great question. We could have 30% higher efficacy in our lamp bulbs today, but the life of the lamp would only be a few hundred hours instead of 1,000 hours, what you expect. So there's an optimization that the industry has evolved over the last 100 years between how many lumens or how much light you get out, what's the efficacy, and the life. It would take a technological innovation to change that and keep all those other, that is, the lumens and the life constant while increasing efficacy. But it's certainly conceivable with some high technology on infrared reflecting films to be able to do that. But remember, you can get that today. You're just only going to have a couple hundred hours of your lamp life, and you're going to be changing light bulbs. But you can get that efficacy today.
All right. Mark, thank you for taking time to talk with us.
My pleasure, Art. Thank you.
You're welcome. Mark Ray is the director of the Lighting Research Center at the Rensselaer Polytech Institute in Troy, New York. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. And now to continue our theme of light bulbs, here is Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
And you certainly have done your homework on this one.
Yes, we did our own illumination investigation this week with David Brooks, who's the owner of a real, it seems like a New York landmark, this place. He's the owner of Just Bulbs. It's on the Upper East Side of New York. And they sell Just Bulbs.
Just Bulbs.
Just Bulbs. Just
and
light bulbs.
Thousands of them in
36,000 different kinds in the store.
Any bulb you ever want, he's got it.
And it's like a shoebox. So it's really, they're crammed into drawers, floor to ceiling. It's very hard to get around. But it's really a neat place if you're in the nearby area and looking for a light bulb. You can't go wrong.
And it's a great place to get educated about the different kinds of bulbs.
Exactly.
Which is what you did.
That's what we did this week. So I was a little bit skeptical about CFLs because the CFL I have in my house, and maybe it's old or I just picked it out wrong, is really ugly. It's that hospital blue color, and it looks terrible. I mean, I turn on the light, and people are like, turn that off. So so we went to see if really there are other options, and it turns out there are six shades of CFLs, ranging from a yellow that approximates an incandescent to the sort of very blue. And more than that, David Brooks was really like, I don't know why anyone would want that really yellow color. It makes everything look antique-y. And he will give you expert advice about what color to choose for your living space.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know, if you have vibrant colors, he says, red or green, go with Florida Sunshine. It's right in the very middle of the spectrum.
There's a bulb that the color is called Florida Sunshine.
How could you go wrong with that?
I feel it already on my skin.
But he said also if you have blue, like dark blues and slates in your house, you might actually want that blue light bulb because it really makes those colors pop out. So interesting.
And that's the advantage of the fluorescence is you can choose your color. You know, with the incandescence, that's it.
It sounds like you're, there's some variation, but you're pretty much stuck. And this, you really can choose your color.
It's just like designer colors. You can go in, and in your video, it's up on our website at sciencefriday.com. It's our video pick of the week. You can see the tour. And David Brooks gives you a sample of each color light, right? And
right.
You show it.
And different shapes. That's the other thing. I thought, okay, maybe some people don't like the spiral or the curly Q thing, but they come in, you know, all different kinds of shapes, the chandelier shape, the sort of normal light bulb shape, but it's frosted. So if you want to just forget it's a CFL, you can't see through it.
And he had some advice for our listeners and viewers is to stock up now, because what did he say? This was amazing.
I hadn't heard this from anybody else, actually, but he says that phosphorus, which is used in CFL production, is sort of going up in price. And so he's heard from his sources that CFLs are about to go up in price. So buy now.
Well, but, he gets to see the price list in advance, so he must know when his new stock is coming in.
But you know what? Most people are hoarding the incandescents, he said.
Is that right?
People are buying. They're calculating how many sockets they have and how long they're going to live. And then they're buying thousands and putting them under their beds, he says.
How long they're going to live.
That is how attached people love. Their love for incandescents cannot be dimmed, Ira.
I can't top that. Thank you for illuminating us.
No, I think you just did.
No, you said it. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Some of you have asked us, why is it necessary to include ads in these podcasts? It's a good question. The simple answer is we have to find some way to pay for them. NPR does not underwrite our podcasts or any of our social media, like our website or our videos. In fact, they only contribute 10% of our total budget. So instead of charging you for this podcast, we put in a couple of ads. If you'd like to help close that deficit, please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the support button and donate a few bucks. Thanks.